Welcome back to the show. It is 31 minutes after the hour. You are listening to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. That is me. I hope you're enjoying the show today. I always appreciate David Wheaton. He thinks so biblically all the time, and he is such a great resource. I've known him as a friend. I think I met David when he was 4. So there you go. We've known him a long time. And what an exceptionally gifted athlete and just a great thinker and a man who just loves Jesus and wants to make him known. So I feel like I'm indulging myself a little bit today because I sometimes will get guests on that I just want to sit and listen to. I just want to say, just talk, and I'll just listen. I got my pen out, and I'll just take notes. My guest on our studio line, Dr. Kent Dunnington, is one of those guests. So I feel like I'm indulging myself because I want him on all the time. And he's author of one of my probably my favorite book on addiction. It's called Addiction and Virtue, Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice. And he's also got a new book coming out called Humility, Pride, and Christian Virtue Theory. So I want to hear about that. I also just want to chat with him because he's so interesting. He's on the studio line. Hello, Kent. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thanks for having me, Bill.
Yeah, I love that you're tackling a new book because I can't wait to read it. And when is it going to be out?
It comes out in December.
Nice. So it's all done, isn't it?
It's all done.
Are you willing to give me a tease today?
Oh, sure. Sure. The book is about humility, about the virtue of humility, what it is and why it matters. But in particular, the book is interested in the question of what difference Christianity makes for the way we think about the virtue of humility.
Mm-hmm.
And humility is one of these really fascinating character traits because it has you might think that everyone has always thought humility was a good thing, but that's far from true. Before Judaism and before Jesus came on the scene, humility was a derogatory term, a way of speaking about people who were not worthwhile, who had no hope of living the good life. And then Judaism and Christianity radically revised that. But there have been a number of reversals. Some of the major thinkers in the Enlightenment, like David Hume, said humility was a monkish virtue and it should be transferred from the column of virtues into the column of vices. So humility has this really fascinating history, and it's one of the best ways of tracking the influence that authentic Christianity has on a culture at any given time. And so this book is about the difference that Christianity makes to how we think about humility and the reason that Christianity's worldview makes humility a good character trait to have.
So, Ken, what is a proper Christian view of humility? Maybe that should be the first question I should ask.
Good. So there are a number of prominent views of humility. The two most popular secular views are that humility is having a sort of low concern for yourself, but not no concern whatsoever. You need to be less concerned about yourself than you are other important things, but you still need to have a strong sense of self-esteem, so on and so forth. So on that view, humility is just not thinking about yourself too often.
Mm-hmm.
On another important view, it has to do with owning your limitations. So, speaking up when you've made a mistake, being aware of all of your shortcomings and trying to do your best to deal with them. Both of those, I think, have a lot right, but they make no mention of God. And from the earliest writings on humility by Christians, humility was a virtue that primarily put us in a position to relate to God. And so I think that the heart of humility for Christians is what I call the embrace of dependence. So it's a glad dependence on God rather than a prideful independence. And so it's what I call a vertical virtue. It's not primarily about relating to other people around us. We often confuse humility with modesty. It's about having the position of glad dependence upon God.
So I'm trying to figure out how I would do a diagnostic on myself about where I fall into the humility scale.
It's hard. in fact, you're not going to do very well.
Okay.
You're best to figure out how you're doing. There's two things that are better than you just sitting there right now and trying to figure out how you're doing. One is pay attention. One is to pay attention when you're going through tremendous hardship.
Okay.
Because there are a number of things that we have a great degree of pride in, but we're not even aware of it until they're taken away from us. So to just give like a really silly example, you think about the way most young men don't think they're proud of their full head of hair, but when it starts to thin out, they're gripped with fear and they're utterly humiliated. And that's a discovery of a kind of pride, and it's also an opportunity for growth and humility. So one of the things is just pay attention to how you feel in moments where you're humiliated. That reveals your level of humility more than anything else. And the other thing is you can ask people, if you have any friends who are very, very honest people,
yeah,
they can probably tell you better than you can whether or not you're growing in humility.
So, Kent, have you had an experience that you could share with us about yourself? Your moment of discovery or your diagnostic where you thought, yeah.
Yeah.
So I'd rather talk about you than
honestly,
me.
Yeah. Well, I can. I mean, we probably don't have too long to talk.
We got plenty of time. That's not an excuse.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
we'll talk till 7 o'clock tonight.
Okay. One of the experiences that really got me thinking about this was a prolonged period of chronic physical suffering. And it was undiagnosed, and I was struggling with a lot of chronic pain. I was still young. I was in graduate school. I needed a lot of energy to be able to do all the things that I had to do, and I was really debilitated. And I was humiliated, too, because I wasn't able to live up to the sort of standards that I had set for myself. And what I realized was that period revealed to me how much my life was organized around what I call in my book an ego ideal, a certain picture of a self that I wanted to be or become that was worthy of love and that merited other people's acknowledgement and recognition. And from that moment on, I really started wrestling with, okay, well, if my true self is not this ego that I'm crafting for myself through achievements and becoming an impressive person, then who is it? What is it? And the more I thought about that and read about that, I realized, well, this is why, St. Augustine said that the center of Christian teaching is humility. It's really because to be a Christian is to learn that our significance, our worth has nothing at all to do with what we in fact spend most of our time trying to develop, which is an impressive self. So that experience set me on the path towards trying to understand this really strange Christian virtue of humility.
I'm just fascinated by this, Ken, and I so appreciate your vulnerability because it sounds like we all do that to some degree. We've got this image in our head of what is going to be our best step forward. And if we can make that step, everyone's going to love us and admire us, and we're going to have a good life. But if anything slows that down, that's when we start to feel panicked.
That's right. No, that's so right. We work with this image of our most impressive self that we think we could become. And if there are little attacks on it here and there, we can make sort of minor adjustments and we can keep the train rolling. But major setbacks like chronic illness or broken engagement or loss of a spouse or loss of a child, they so utterly wreck our picture of our ideal self that we sort of float around in a wasteland of confusion for some time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think painful as those things are, what they reveal to us is how much of our life is energized by the quest for a certain kind of ego ideal. And the question is there an alternative way? And does grace really provide a different way of living that isn't constantly energized by the quest to become someone important?
Kent, how connected is ego and humility? I know that's kind of a dumb question, but I ask those often.
No, I don't think it's a dumb question all. I think humility is fundamentally about the attempt to subdue the ego.
Okay.
But you can imagine how, from a certain perspective, it wouldn't make much sense for us to try to subdue the ego. I mean, that's one of the really strange things about the historical legacy of humility is, if you ask people nowadays, you know, what do you think of humility? They're gonna say it's a good thing. But when it comes down to it, what we really think means achievement and a worthwhile life is building a really impressive self. And so I think there's a lot of ambivalence in our culture about whether we really want to be the kind of people who subdue our egos, or whether we really want to be the kind of people who unabashedly and unashamedly self-promote. And I think Christians feel this tension in a major way in the work that they do, because we really do live in a culture that teaches and trains us to self-promote, and yet we read scriptures that teach and train us to sacrifice ourselves and to expend ourselves in service. And so I do think the question of, what is the status of my ego? Is this something I should be building up, or something I should be gradually giving away, is a central question of Christian discipleship.
Hmm. So wise. Now, Kent, what about feigned humility when, like, you hit 15 three-pointers in a row? Somebody says, whoa, you are really good. And I go, got lucky. When I know it was pure skill.
That's right. So yeah, false humility.
Yeah,
or the nowadays, you know, you'll hear folks talk about the humble brag. So
yeah, the humble brag.
In a way of, yeah, these are great examples of how the appearance of humility becomes yet another part of the quest to be an impressive self. And so, you know, the early monastic literature, which that's the literature written by very early monks, so-called desert Muslim fathers, they're onto this very early, and they say, look, for all we talk about humility, the wish to appear humble is one of the great traps to becoming a genuinely humble person. So I actually think this is obviously important in our own lives. I mean, to be falsely humble is just to be a liar, and there's no virtue in that. But I think it's also really important for the way we raise children, because we often do beat a certain kind of performance of humility into our children, so that they learn to act like they're humble when they're really not. And so I think we have to be really careful about how we teach children what humility is and what true humility looks like.
Yeah, I love the humble brag. Yeah, I'd really like to go have lunch with you, but I got to go wash my Ferrari.
Yeah, exactly.
Kent, you're the best. Let me take a little break. More with Kent Dunnington in just a minute. It's 15 minutes until the top of the hour. I'll be right back. We are back. Dr. Kent Dunnington is my guest. He's associate professor of philosophy and teaches and writes in the areas of virtue ethics and theological ethics. You know, I get a lot of authors on my show, as you would guess, and I do talk about their books. I don't personally go to bat very often for authors, but I will go to bat for Kent, because I think his book, Addiction and Virtue, Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice, is one of the best books written on addiction. And we're spending most of today, well, I should say all of today, talking about a book coming out in December, which we're previewing it right now. And trust me, we'll have him back on after I get my hands on a copy, and we'll go through it one more time. But we're talking about his new book coming out in December, Humility, Pride, and Christian Virtue Theory. And we've been talking about humility to this point. But, Kent, I'd like to talk about pride, because that's a very interesting word in today's world.
It is, yes. And it, like humility, has a really up and down path. Aristotle, who was a sort of most well-known ancient ethicist that we often still read, had a virtue called magnanimity, which is, if not pride, at least a near cousin of pride. And if you were to read his descriptions of a person who possessed magnanimity, you would think, wow, this guy is really puffed up. He's really full of himself. Aristotle said that the truly magnanimous man was someone with a deep voice and a slow walk who did not condescend to speak or interact with those beneath him and spent time only with those who were at or above his social standing. And when we hear about that today, of course, we're so informed by the legacy of Christian humility that we think this guy sounds like a real jerk.
But, that's what I was thinking.
but Aristotle thought that it was obvious that the goal of human life was to build the most impressive self that you could build. And to do that, you needed to avoid lowliness, humiliation, poverty, poor breeding, all of those things, like the plague. And so there's, in the same way that humility has sort of seesawed back and forth down through the centuries, pride has as well. And early Christians never, ever spoke of pride as a virtue or as anything that could be possessed and used well. But around the time of the Enlightenment, people like David Hume and particularly Immanuel Kant claimed that humility needed to be counterbalanced by what was called proper pride or noble pride. And it's very controversial to suggest that there is no such thing as proper pride, but I am inclined toward that view, that pride is always a form of achieving and maintaining self-importance, and that that's simply incompatible with our calling as Christians.
So a lot of people are obsessed with their idea of self-importance, and yeah, and so they're hard people to be around.
Yes, yeah, I mean, I think we can all agree that people who are obsessed with themselves to the exclusion of all other interests are hard to be around, not good citizens, and therefore in no way are they models for us or for other people. The harder case is people who have what looks like a really appropriate balance between humility and pride, so that in general they're not so obsessed with themselves that they can't pay attention to others and devote themselves to other causes, but yet they still carefully protect a sense of their own importance, and when it's threatened, will guard it. And it's hard to know. I think there's a long history of natural wisdom that suggests that's how you ought to be anything other than that is to be a doormat, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the challenge for Christianity, I think, is it really true what Jesus said, that the last shall be first? And even there, if the last shall be first, and so we just try to be last so that we can come in first, isn't that just another performance of pride, right? So there's a real puzzle in the gospel call that says, he who would save his life will give it up. Is that just sort of a way of gaming the system? That's what Nietzsche says. And uh-huh. Nietzsche was a great critic of humility, and he said Jesus was the proudest person ever because he convinced everyone else that by way of lowliness, they would one day be exalted and look down on all the sinners from heaven, right? And I think if that's true, if that's what Christianity is all about, then Nietzsche was right. And so a big part of what I try to do in the book is to show how humility is not just a strategy of self-exaltation. It is really a fundamentally different way of living.
Is it really busy in your head?
Is it busy in my head?
Yeah.
Sometimes it is. Certainly when I'm reading and thinking and writing, it is quite busy. But it doesn't feel that way today. I feel quite calm.
No, I know. You sound really calm, but I'm just thinking the way you process all this, it's so interesting. When we get to Christian virtue theory, you're going to have to help me because mm-hmm. I don't even know what that means.
Yeah, it's kind of a mouthful, and I should say, I mean, this book is a more academic book, and so there are these sections of this book that are a bit of a slog, you know, so if you need some good bedtime reading, Bill, this will help you out.
Okay.
But Christian virtue theory is just the study of the virtues. It's really simple. It raises two fundamental questions. What are the virtues? That is to say, what are the character traits that lead to a life of flourishing, and how do you develop them? What are the kinds of practices that help you gain the virtues, virtues like humility, but also like courage and temperance and prudence? And then there's been this long question of, well, are the virtues something that are the same for all people at all times and that are knowable by what's called universal reason? That is to say, just in virtue of thinking about the way the world is, the way human beings are, should we be able to know what the human virtues are? And some people say yes. Others, and among them many Christians, say no. In the revelation of Jesus Christ, we learn about a fundamentally different way of being a human being. And it's a way of being a human being that, given the fallen condition of the world, is not obvious immediately to people. So the idea that you could self-sacrifice even to the point of death, for instance, does not look like flourishing. And yet, if Jesus is our model of flourishing, we have something to learn there. So Christian virtue theory is the study of the virtues and how you develop them from the perspective that takes the gospel as truth.
Okay. So we just have a couple of minutes left. I'm just curious, as a philosopher, what questions do you get asked the most?
Depends on whom I'm talking with. If I'm talking with Christians, the question that I get asked the most is, you know, is what's it like to be a Christian in the academy? Because there's an assumption, and it's somewhat justified, that being in academia is to be in a world where God is, you know, denied.
Okay.
And where you're even sort of ridiculed and mocked and oppressed for being Christian. That is not true in my experience, but that's what Christians ask me the most. Non-Christians ask me, how in the world is an intelligent person like you a Christian? And I was just talking to some high school students last week, and one woman who's getting ready to graduate high school said, I just don't understand how a person with a PhD who appears to be intelligent could ever believe in the virgin birth. So I get stories like that, or I get questions like that all the time, and those are my favorite conversations to have.
So what does it mean to live a good life?
I think to live a good life is to pursue the way of Jesus. That is to say, to discover ourselves as creatures of God through and through, who live by his love and into his love. And I think simply to learn how to rest in our status as creatures of the good God is, although it sounds simple, it's enough to keep us busy for a lifetime. And I think, our destiny. And so to try to begin to align ourselves with that destiny of resting in the love of God as his beloved creatures, that is what a good life is all about.
Mm-hmm. Ken, in a conversation I had earlier today, I was talking about just the amount of division in this country. And if we're trying to live a good life and we're trying to live for Christ and living in a world now that feels so divided, what is your take on how we as Christians can be healers in this world and not dividers?
You know, that's a great question, Bill. And there's so much we said there.
Yeah, there's not a lot of time left, so I'm giving you a big out here. So
I'll say one thing.
Okay.
The place to start is with individual people. You know, Jesus changed the world and all of history by calling around in 12 people and becoming their friends. And I really think that we're not going to figure out how to solve the political divide in our country, but we can figure out how to be friends with our neighbors. And that's the place, I think, to start.
I love it. So when the book comes out, it'll take me a while to read because I'm a slow reader, and
okay.
I don't comprehend very well. So I'm going to have a lot of questions, and I'd love to have you back on the show, and you can answer my specific questions after I read the book. How about that?
That sounds great.
Thank you so much, Kent. You're a delight to have on the show, and thank you for saying yes when we call you.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's good to be with you, Bill. Take care.
Thank you so much. Dr. Kent Dunnington has been my guest on the show, and I recommend his book, Addiction and Virtue, Beyond the Models of Disease and Choice. Just an excellent book. Say, coming up on November 1st, if you're at all interested, we're going to do Afternoons with Bill Arnold live right here at KTIS, right here at the studio. So you can come and witness It's like making sausage. You can see how it works. A live presentation of the show November 1st. It's a Thursday. We'd love for you to come in and have fun, have some fun with us. Go to myfaithradio.com. You can check out the Afternoons with Bill Arnold page, and you can get a seat. You can reserve a spot to come and have some fun with us. That's coming up on Thursday, November 1st. We'd love to see you. Have a great night, everyone. God bless. I'll see you tomorrow.